Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, zip up your leather pants, slap on the clown paint, and don't forget to eat something light as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
Coming to you live from Monsteropolis in the great state of Ohio. Monsteropolis, home of monsters, anomalies, and legends. And also this show that is co-hosted by myself. I am Seth Breedlove, and I'm joined by
Mark Matzke. And it is a busy day in Monsteropolis, is it not?
It's very busy. We had a man just walk up to the window earlier and stare in at us, which I think is a thing. So for listeners who are unaware, we're in an actual recording studio, which is a little different from how Sasquatch was recorded. Yeah. We were not together most of the time. So we are together. We're able to record this together in the Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM studios. And I greatly prefer this, actually.
Yes.
Like, I just feel like there's... I always prefer to actually be with the person I'm recording with. And I know, like, I used to do a comic book podcast, and we were all in different states.
Yeah.
And it was nightmarish at times to record. Mm-hmm. So this is great for me. Thank you to 97.1 FM Wadsworth Community Radio for having us and for having us on the air. The show broadcasts on Wadsworth Community Radio at an undisclosed time slot. I'm still not sure of when it's actually going to be broadcast, but it broadcasts on Wadsworth Radio, and then it is also put up on our podcast stream. So if you're listening through the radio, you can listen to back episodes on our podcast, and if you are listening on the podcast and you want to listen quote unquote live, you can on 97.1 FM in the Wadsworth area. And as long as we're talking about that, special thanks to our sponsor, Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth, possibly run by my father-in-law.
possibly. That's the rumor.
That's the rumor. So anyway, let's get into it. So last week we talked about the Bermuda Triangle, an area where ships and planes go missing. I almost just quoted Invasion on Chestnut Ridge, an area of the Bermuda Triangle where... so anyway, this week we're going to talk about the Bridgewater Triangle, located in Massachusetts. This time around, I wrote about... So do you want to real quickly explain the window area thing again for listeners?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that makes sense. We're talking about, you know, it's part of the aforementioned Triangle Trilogy, and... that all started with the Bermuda Triangle, of course, being a convenient way to talk about a place, a location, where unexplained things tend to happen with greater frequency than other places. But the idea of the window, or the, you know, these areas, are that there appears to be places in our world where the separation between the seen and the unseen is more thin than in other places. And John Keel was instrumental, I think, in bringing that idea forward to the reading public anyway. And so the essential idea is that the material seen world is, of course, what we usually see and sense, but that the supernatural realm is generally hidden to our perception, and there seems to be a separation between the two that we cannot cross at will. But there are places and times where the separation between those two is less, it's thinner. And what that means then is that whatever is, quote unquote, behind the curtain can come through to our side and be perceived. And the kind of the scarier idea even behind that is that perhaps there are times where we on this side can go and in a likewise manner cross the void the other way. And that may be behind some of the fears being expressed in these areas of disappearances and so forth. And on the mass scale, we looked at that with the Bermuda Triangle, but with the Bridgewater Triangle, it's more of a local and no less scary, in some ways more scary, effect that that has on people.
I would assume we're going to be referencing something a lot throughout this episode, or at least I want to reference it now, so it's out there. But my friend Aaron Cadieu directed a movie called Bridgewater Triangle that'll take you visually through this entire story of that area. It's a very well done documentary. In fact, it was one of the first I watched for reference when I was getting into making movies. And Aaron was very gracious to me when I was first making my first movie. He made phone calls to me. He helped me with ridiculously stupid technical issues I was having very graciously when I was first getting into all this. So I want to make sure we talk about the Bridgewater Triangle movie. I actually think it's free right now on Amazon Prime. Mm-hmm. So if you have Amazon Prime, you can go on there and watch it. And it's a really creepy movie. And it goes into, he did a great job of really exploring all the different angles of that area. And despite the fact that it's like a 90-minute plus long movie, it never feels long or anything over long or anything like that. So it's a really great introduction to this particular subject. But the Bridgewater Triangle is located in the edges of the Bridgewater Triangle are Abington, Rehoboth, and Freetown. It's located in Massachusetts, and the term Bridgewater Triangle was coined by our friend Lauren Coleman. So I wanted to make sure we mentioned that right at the top. And then I have a question for you, because I couldn't find this anywhere.
Okay.
And I didn't look on a map for some reason.
All right.
How far is Dover from...
Oh, it's a good question. I don't know right offhand. The thing that I thought of was its relationship to Boston.
Mm-hmm.
It's only 30 miles south of Boston.
Because Massachusetts isn't very big, but... I'm curious to know, like, how far that the town and if Dover is maybe connected or not. I'd be curious to
right
to learn
how close
about that.
It might be.
Because I think we both really like that Dover demon story,
oh, and no
that's
doubt.
That's what we're referencing here. But this is all Lauren Coleman's area. A lot of the work in the Bridgewater Triangle, particularly involving cryptids, involved Lauren Coleman. Do you have anything to add to that particular piece of it, though, Lauren Coleman?
Well, it just, you know, the first people tend to point to Mysterious America as the place where that appeared for the first time in writing. And I think that's right. Mm-hmm. I mean, and Lauren, you know, as the one who coined the term, as you said.
And it's strange because if you think about it, it is a place that draws on all of the sort of like cryptid creature report type creatures that he is known for investigating, even up to large snakes, which I thought was cool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And what's really interesting to me is that it didn't really gain traction as a way of referencing that area for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, and I'm pretty sure the movie had a lot to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
Now Bridgewater Triangle is pretty well known.
I mean, the movie
shorthand
did,
way of talking about it.
I would almost say that the movie did better than any of mine. Like the movie went on to get picked up by Destination America and played on TV in an abbreviated form. I think they cut it down to like 45 minutes. There was a new narrator brought in, stuff like that. I've never seen the abbreviated version, but it's extremely well known now because of this. And I mean, the other reason I was always aware of the Bridgewater Triangle, in part because of Spooky South Coast, which is a podcast I used to listen to when I worked in medical billing, and all I had to do was listen to podcasts. That was Spooky South Coast, is like I've always talked about it being one of the shows that kind of helped me form an interest in these subjects, and that was where my knowledge of the Bridgewater Triangle even began. Would have been Spooky South Coast even before that movie came along.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's very popular.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because they are still doing Bridgewater Triangle shows mm-hmm. where they send groups out to some of the places we'll be talking about tonight mm-hmm. and have them each report in over the course of an episode.
Is that at Halloween that they do that?
Typically, but it's been at different times. And I think there's a member or somebody that they know very well who was leaving before Halloween, so they wanted to do it early.
Okay.
So that their latest one, I think, was released earlier in the month.
So one thing I love about Bridgewater is like it's almost like it would make a great book series or a movie series or something, because there's so many. It's Bridgewater Triangle, so it's a large area, but there's these specific locations within the triangle that keep coming up over and over again. Profile Rocks, one they hear a lot of, the Hockomock Swamp, Freetown State Forest seems to be where a lot of the satanic gangland killing weird murder stuff started happening.
Mm-hmm.
My phone just started reading what I was saying. I was insanely...
You're dictating.
I looked down and it was taking it all down.
Wow.
So that's really interesting. But I wanted to start with something that I noticed, and I mentioned it like two episodes ago. The similarities between the Bridgewater Triangle and the Point Pleasant, wherein you've got these, you were talking about window areas and John Keel. And did Keel ever have anything to do with the Bridgewater Triangle?
I don't think so. I don't think so, yeah.
The first thing that jumped out to me was, so I'm going to read you something. Some say that the wounded and pained spirits of the Wampanoag are the reason for the paranormal in the swamp. That is part of the explanation, but I would go further. I think the vortex was in place in the swamp before the settlers and before Native Americans. That vortex contributed to the inhumanity of the war between the Wampanoag and the English, and it fosters pain and evil in that area to this day. That is super creepy mm-hmm. and a really great setup for a place that something, there's like an ancient evil or something that exists in that area. That may have even influenced what people have now sort of created this mythology around, which is this King Philip's War.
Mm-hmm.
King Philip was Metacomet. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they called him King Philip. He wanted an English name, so they called him King Philip. He waged war between the years of 1675 and 1678 between Indian inhabitants of New England and New England colonists and their Indian allies. The war was named for Metacomet and the Wampanoag chief who adopted the name Philip because of the friendly relations between his father and the Mayflower Pilgrims. The war continued in the most northern reaches of New England until the signing of the Treaty of Casco Bay. Casco mm-hmm. Bay, of course, would be connected to Lauren Coleman. The Casco Bay Sea Serpent, which is something that he has sort of at least built something of a reputation for being involved in April 1678. When he was killed, he was shot and killed, and the curse, supposedly he placed this curse upon that area, what became known as the Bridgewater Triangle. And that, I thought, was a very interesting connection between King Philip and, of course, Chief Cornstalk, the Native American chief who was killed near Point Pleasant, supposedly also placed a curse on the area. And that's the interesting thing about Point Pleasant and Bridgewater. So often people just think of Point Pleasant as the place where the Mothman is seen. But the Mothman, for those that have done any real research into that, the Mothman's just one tiny piece of Point Pleasant's bizarre history, right? Like, it's not like that's all that's going on there. How do I fix this stand? It keeps trying to move away from me. So anyway, I thought that was an interesting connection. These two places where really weird phenomena are occurring. Point Pleasant tends to be more UFO-centric and less cryptid other than the Mothman. But the Bridgewater kind of has this smorgasbord of phenomena taking place within it. And its roots, at least as far as the mainstream is concerned, seem to be sort of going back to this curse.
Yeah.
And Native American presence in this area comes up constantly. You can't get away from it. It's very rooted. That entire area is very rooted in its history, which is all, I feel like all New England mm-hmm. is that way.
Yeah. I mean, just in the place names alone.
Yeah.
You know, cities and towns, mm-hmm. a lot of the prominent locations within the triangle that have a supernatural history to them, like Anawan Rock, which is where, you know, after Metacomet was killed, his general surrendered there. And that's a location where, you know, to this day, there's people claim to see, you know, campfires and smoke, even Native American apparitions, you know, walking around in the woods. And there truly is this sense of the deep history and the tragedy of the area.
Mm-hmm.
Profile Rock is another.
So for those that don't know, Profile Rock literally looks like the profile of a Native American face is what I would, I mean, it looks mm-hmm. like a face on the side of this cliff. And that was apparently always there. They would actually, that was kind of a landmark that they would return to you for meetings and stuff like that. So that's interesting that that was always there. The sort of legend about that rock, Profile Rock, is that there's a ghost that sits atop of it.
Mm-hmm.
And each of these locations you'll find have their own ghosts and legends. And that's what I was talking about within... Sure, there's this greater Bridgewater Triangle name given to this giant it's 200 miles, right? About 200 miles?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That what we're looking at? Yeah, 200-mile section of the state of Massachusetts. But within it, there's all these little locations. It really reminds me of Chestnut Ridge, where you've got mm-hmm. little landmarks and spots where really strange things happen. You've even got Thunderbird sightings, which we're going to get to, I'm sure.
Right.
But like you were saying with some of these different locations, Hockomock Swamp's one that comes up. Dighton Rock comes up.
Yeah.
Dighton Rock, can we talk about that real quick?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, that's fascinating.
Start us off then on that.
Well, yeah, Dighton Rock is this large rock on which there are a number of inscriptions, I guess you could say. I mean, it almost looks like graffiti that's been etched into it, but there is great controversy and question about who wrote on it and what are they trying to communicate? And there's, even when you go there today, evidently they've built sort of a shelter house around the rock so that nothing happens to it. And then inside, they have displays that are set up that indicate who might have written on the rock. And so you've got Vikings, you've got Portuguese, Phoenicians even, and Native Americans are among the groups that are, it's theorized that they contributed at least to writing on or inscribing something on the rock to some degree. I mean, and there's nothing necessarily paranormal or supernatural about it.
No, there isn't.
But just the history
of
it.
It's just the mystery of who actually etched on it, what it's saying. They don't seem to know. Although mm-hmm. the theory seems to be that it's telling the story of locals who engaged in a battle between people who came by ship,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting as well.
Yeah.
Obviously, that part of the country, there's sort of this Viking history, potential history, going back to like Leif Erikson and all that stuff. So mm-hmm. it could be something to do with that. But that reminds me of like any of these other areas where we talk about, there's like a very rich sort of history that's rooted in the bizarre. So like Bridgewater's always seemingly been a place that's sort of rooted in strange history mm-hmm. and like strange happenings. Hockomock, though, is the name that comes up the most when you're going through all of this.
Yeah.
Freetown is the area. So it's like the way I started separating in my head was like, Hockomock is fun. it seems to be sort of like the hub of like UFO and creepy like paranormal activity and cryptids and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Freetown seems to be where the real... messy,
yeah.
dirty murder and some really super disturbing
dark. Yeah.
stuff happens. And I think we both spent time today even researching both of those angles. But can we talk about Hockomock?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
It was called Devil's Swamp by settlers in colonial times. Hockomock Swamp contained within parts of Bridgewater, East and Norton, Rainham, Taunton and West Bridgewater, crossed by a number of roads. There's a lot of info here. I just like copied and pasted, but it is supposed to be a very rich sort of swampy environ. My favorite story in going through all of this came from the Thomas Downey Thunderbird sighting, and I can find very little info on this.
Mm-hmm.
But Thomas Downey was a Norton police officer, and he saw a giant pterodactyl-like bird in the Hockomock Swamp, reported it, and was pretty much laughed off the off the force. I mean, I think he stayed on the force, but he was he's pretty much made a mockery of. And this is what I was talking about with like Lauren Coleman's involvement is that this area, the Bridgewater Triangle, has everything. It's got the typical cryptids like thunderbirds and pterodactyl like flying beings, but it's also got giant snakes. And I knew you would want to talk about that, so I wanted to open the door for that, because there's a similarity there between that and it started reading my text again.
It's the triangle.
There's similarity between that and the Cuyahoga Valley National Park and the Peninsula Python. So do you want to tell us a little bit about the stovepipe-sized?
Yeah, the stovepipe-sized giant snakes.
Yeah.
And even the timing is somewhat similar. You know, it suggests something. But I guess in the case of the Bridgewater Triangle, you know, it was around the 1930s, and you had the civil service groups building things there, which brings up, don't let me forget to talk about railroads before we go.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, there
similarities there between Bridgewater, the Hockomock Swamp, Bridgewater Triangle, and the great swamp, the Great Black Swamp that stretched from northern Ohio into Indiana.
Mm-hmm. Sorry. So they were doing building in the 30s in the general vicinity of Hockomock Swamp, and they encountered large snakes that were, you know, the classic description is that they were the size of a stovepipe. So, I mean, that's as far as the descriptions that I saw or heard about, you know, suggests sort of the Peninsula Python, out of place, non-native snake in that area, and just begs the question, you know, what were they doing there? Mm-hmm. The Peninsula Python, to me, there's some very good practical explanations as to why there might have been a giant snake there. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly in the Hockomock sense, there's more of the door is left open to more of a supernatural connotation you know, as to why they would be present.
Yeah, I found a conspiracy, and this is neither here nor there, but I found a conspiracy website, it was called Revelation something.
Mm-hmm.
And they were drawing similarities between, they were literally going through phenomena by phenomena throughout the Bridgewater Triangle and drawing a correlation between it and Revelation.
Oh, wow.
And the snake was obviously the devil himself, you know, like hanging out in the swamp, which I don't necessarily buy into, but it's an interesting road to go down.
Yeah.
When you're thinking about a place where all of a sudden, like, there's a giant snake and you're like, that's the devil, and this is like the setting up of the end times.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was, I found that this morning and I spent probably 20 minutes going down the rabbit hole with them.
Sure.
So.
Well, from a symbolic standpoint, there's a lot of suggestive stuff there. For sure.
Yeah, very interesting. Hockomock also has ghost lights, which, you know, like if I ever had the opportunity, I would make an entire documentary about ghost lights, because it's like the only thing I've seen. With my own eyes, it's the only weird, quote unquote, paranormal, you know, thing that I've seen was that night that I was with my dad. We were near a swamp, weirdly enough, and we saw, which probably swamp gas, right? Isn't that the most common?
That's what they say.
Yeah.
They say.
We saw Project Blue Book.
Yeah.
We saw this like weird glowing orange light rise up across the valley and then drift back down into the trees. And that was near a swamp. So I've actually seen that sort of thing with my own eyes. And I'm always drawn to stories of ghost lights, spook lights, whenever I see them. But apparently that is a pretty common thing. Ghosts come up constantly throughout Bridgewater, but especially it seems like Hockomock Swamp. And then Bigfoot, which I think is where we get into, I don't know if I wrote this guy's name down, but there's a, I really quickly wanted to mention this. Alexander Petikov, my buddy Alexander, did a short episode of his Bigfoot YouTube series, and you can check this out. It's free. It's like a 9-minute, I thought I wrote the name down, but it doesn't look like it did. He did a 9-minute YouTube short. Did you watch it by any chance? I should have sent you the
link. It sounds familiar.
Okay, it's called like Hunting for Bigfoot in the Bridgewater Triangle. And it's a 9-minute YouTube short that Alexander Petikov did about Joe DeAndre.
Yeah.
He's the very he's quite a character. He wears the sort of classic safari hat.
Right. Yeah.
Like safari outfits. And apparently he had a Bigfoot sighting. And I believe it was in Hakamaka, if I'm not.
Yeah. It was by one of the clay banks.
Okay.
Ponds. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He had a Bigfoot sighting in Hakamaka Swamp and kind of became the typical like Bigfoot hunter, especially in the 70s and 80s, like just constantly going on quote unquote expeditions into the swamps trying to find Bigfoot. And there are a number of Bigfoot sightings from that area over the years. And Lauren's documented a number of those in his work. His Monsters of Massachusetts book has a couple different sightings, but I think he's got more throughout his work if you want to, you know, like seek those out.
Right.
Bigfoot, Bigfoot, giant snake, thunderbird, spook lights, constant ghost stories. There's ghost stories throughout the Hockomock Swamp. Mm-hmm. And then we get into what else do you want to add about Hockomock?
Oh, well, UFOs, too.
Yeah.
I mean, classic sort of everything from saucer shaped to even more atypical sort of diamond shape UFOs and things like that.
Are you talking about the newsman?
Yeah.
Okay, so there was, I didn't write their names down or anything because I'm an idiot, but there, I don't think I did. One of probably the most famous UFO sighting from the Bridgewater Triangle, I think, was seen by two newsmen. And this was in the 70s or 80s? 80s?
When was that?
Again,
I want to say
this is just my great research.
80s or 90s.
Okay.
It was fairly recent.
And they were, I believe they were in a car and they saw this bright light behind these trees, and then they proceeded to see what actually to them looked like the home plate at a home plate at a baseball game.
Yeah.
Or on a baseball field. And it had a bright light on it, and it came up over the trees and flew over the car and off into the night. And the reason it's so well known is because these guys are fairly well known news reporters, or were fairly known news reporters in Massachusetts at the time. And I don't know if they both were, but I know one of them was a hardened skeptic, like just completely skeptical about anything relating to the paranormal. And he couldn't believe what he'd seen, and it really sort of changed his view on the entire ufology in general, like UFO sightings and stuff like that. There's definitely a long history of UFO sightings in the area. In fact, I found sightings that go all the way back to the original settlers in the area seeing strange lights in the sky.
Yeah. Yeah. And the one that stands out there goes back to 1760.
Ooh.
May 10th, 1760, residents of Bridgewater and Roxbury saw a sphere of fire that was brighter than the sun. It was so bright that it was, you know, the middle of the day. And it cast a shadow, you know, so that there is a deep history there of strange lights in the sky. And one of my favorite Hockomock Swamp stories is Halloween night, 1908. There were two undertakers driving a carriage, and they around 3 a.m. there's this unusually strong light. They said it was like a brighter than a lantern, and it looked vaguely like a hot air balloon, but they couldn't put it all together.
Yeah.
Just a really cool story as well. I mean, I love sort of the, it sets up like it's a tall tale, really. I mean, you know, it's Halloween night to start out, and then two undertakers. I mean, it just seems like it's headed somewhere, but the fact that it's a UFO instead of a black dog or something more ghostly just sort of gives you an idea of how jumbled some of these accounts are. You know, it mixes up the genres oftentimes.
See, I'm actually finding myself like frantically trying to get to some things in this episode. We're already down to like 10 minutes left. Can we talk real quick about Pukwudgies?
Oh, yeah, of course.
So, like, Pukwudgies are, I love this, and at some point I want to do these as a movie. In fact, it was like part of our, there's actually a rich history of Pukwudgies in Indiana. I don't know if you know about that.
I did not know that.
So Tim Balzano, is it Tim Balzano? Balzano, last name, did a lot of research into Pukwudgies, and I know most of what I know because of him. And listening to Spooky South Coast, because he very often talked about them. But I found this like breakdown of what a Pukwudgie is, and this might have even just been on like Wikipedia or something, but a Pukwudgie is translated by Henry Schoolcraft as little wild man of the woods that vanishes. A creature found in Delaware and Wampanoag folklore, sometimes said to be 2 to 3 feet tall, According to legend, puck wedges can appear and disappear. It will lure people to their deaths, use magic, launch poison arrows, and create fire. Native Americans believe the puck wedges were once friendly to humans but then turned against them and are best left alone. According to lore, a person who annoyed a puck wedgie would be subject to nasty tricks by it, or subject to being followed by the puck wedgie, who would cause trouble to them. They are known to kidnap people, push them off cliffs, attack their victims with short knives and spears, and to sand... Wait, and to use sand to blind their victims. This was really interesting. So this is, Bolzano actually wrote this on Spooky South Coast. I'm going to keep referencing them. They continue to see them. He's talking about people in that, people that live in or travel into the Bridgewater Triangle. They continue to see them, and as the world develops around them, the monsters remain unchanged and as dark as ever. And then he references this story, which I thought was cool. Joan was walking her dog through the state forest in Freetown, Massachusetts, on a cold Saturday morning in April when she saw the monster. As she and her dog, Sid, walked down the path, Sid became anxious and strayed a few feet into the woods. Joan followed him in and stopped down the path. Wait. Sid became anxious and strayed a few feet into the woods. Joan followed him in and stopped short. Her dog was lying completely flat in the leaves, and on a rock 10 feet away was a pug wedgie. She described him as looking like what she described as a troll, 2 feet high with pale gray skin and hair on his arms and on top of his head. Monster seemed to have no clothes, but it was difficult to tell because his stomach hung over his waist, almost touching his knees. His eyes were a deep green, and he had large lips and a long, almost canine nose.
Hmm.
The puck wedgie stood watching her, staring straight at her with no expression, almost like it was stunned to see her. Joan froze and remembers thinking the air in her lungs had been pushed out. Sid finally came to and ran back toward the trail, dragging Joan, who was still holding the leash tightly. There's more stories, by the way. The puck wedgie stories have always creeped me out. The most famous one is Bill Russo's story. I'm going to tell the really abbreviated version of this. Basically, he was walking his dog one night. I have the whole thing here, actually. So he's with his dog.
Yeah.
Bill is... Wait, is that the name? No. Sam. The dog's name is Sam. Sam starts whimpering, and he said it was very strange because Sam's sort of an outdoor dog. He knew what he was doing outdoors. He wasn't really prone to being afraid. Dog starts whimpering. He asks her what's wrong, and then he hears... a voice, and this is late at night in his neighborhood, and he hears this voice, and the voice is saying, "Kier, kier, e want you, kier, 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 e want you," going on, a high-pitched voice, and this was, what I'm reading from is actually written by Bill. You can find Bill's actual account online. He said its pitch was intensifying like the siren of a speeding fire truck. It might be a toddler. He didn't know what it was. He turns and something was moving in the shadows, walking slowly into the center of the light cast by the street lamp. It stopped and lifted a hairy hand or paw, palm inward. Its scooped hand moving. It was beckoning me to come forward. Kier chu, e want you, kier chu, e want you. Sam tried to pull me away. Now she was rattling so badly, I was afraid she would break her leg joints. Her head down, near tears, she would not look at the strange beast that was summoning me. It must be a kid. He wandered out into the night. I had to help him. Are you okay? Do you need help? He goes on. He asks it. Anyway, this thing, whatever it was, eventually they basically, Bill and his dog turned and ran back home. But he, what's really interesting about Bill is you can see him in the Bridgewater Triangle movie. And he still seems very affected by the sighting of what basically seems to be a 2 or 3 foot tall Ewok. I mean, that's really what like a puck wedgie account comes down to, is like, it's almost laughable in a way, but there is something very unnerving about the fact that it was saying, we want you.
Yeah. Right.
Like we want you.
And that goes right with the folklore, doesn't it? Yeah. I mean, they're luring people.
Well, and that's
into
what's so strange about
darkness.
It. Yeah. And I mean, there's, so to me, that is like the definition of like folklore, like a local legend. But it seems to, if people are going to make up a story about something, why would you make up a story about puck wedgies?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, and it's something that's been part of the local folklore going back to that's a Wampanoag story, and Wampanoag is the tribe that also supposedly cast the curse on the area. So, I mean, there's a lot of like really bizarre things about Puckwudgies that I think are really fascinating. Mm-hmm. And when you look into it, they're these trickster, these tiny tricksters who are like kidnapping people. So it seems very silly and harmless on the surface. And then you start looking at the actual sort of mythology surrounding them, and it becomes really unnerving, especially because there's dogs constantly come up, which actually is similar in a way, I guess, to Bigfoot. But dogs are constantly seemingly at the mercy of the Puckwudgies.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do much like reading into the Puckwudgie stuff?
Not beyond that, what you just said. But it was interesting in the two anecdotes that you shared. I mean, there were lots of parallels. I mean, they were both walking dogs. Mm-hmm. The description of the creature was almost exactly the same. You know, I think Bill Russo in the film, he describes the face as almost like a chimpanzee.
Mm-hmm.
And so with the muzzle, it's pretty freaky the way that those line up as far as being parallel accounts. They seem very similar. They're describing clearly the same type of thing, even with the potbelly description.
Well, there's one other here. I'm trying to hurry, and I hate to take up so much time on this, but this was cool. And again, this is all from Spooky South Coast and Tim Bolzano. Tim was in a forest when he saw a bright orb in front of him. Having investigated the paranormal, he was excited and tried to snap a photo with his digital camera. Ball of light disappeared and reappeared a few feet further into the woods. Tim followed, losing the spirit several times before he realized he had traveled more than 30 feet off the path into a thickly wooded area. He became scared and slowly made his way back to the path, only to find a 2-foot man standing there walking towards him. He turned and ran, and looking back, saw the figure move back into the woods. He reported that he had moved with a slight limp, but like a human. So he saw basically a tiny Puckwudgie after he sees an orb. So I thought that was kind of a cool
And there's
story
a
too.
Luring element to mm-hmm. that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that he was.
Yeah, that goes all the way back to the legends, to the Wampanoag. Where does it lure people to their deaths? Use magic, launch poison arrows, and create fire. Don't mess with them.
No, exactly.
Yeah. So we got to get to the true crime element of this, I think, right?
Yeah. One more thing on Hockamock. Did you hear there's the derivative Hobomock?
Mm-mm.
And that was the Wampanoag deity of death and disease.
Oh, no way.
That was composed of human souls of the dead.
Whoa.
So Hockamock and Hobomock are, you know, are loan words from each other. And I think that they clearly have some type of transference there of meaning.
I can't recommend Alexander's mini doc enough because he's got a lot of drone footage of the swamp and stuff. And you can really get a kind of a perspective on how big that area is. Satanism in Fall River. Why don't you take the lead on this part?
Okay. Well, along with the more fun elements, there's some disturbing history in this same region that seems to be centered around the Fall River area, and in particular the Freetown State Forest. It's a huge area that seems to attract, for obvious and maybe some non-obvious reasons, all types of nefarious activity. The obvious being under the cover of darkness, you can conceal a lot of things. In particular, the region and, in fact, the nation was sort of rocked by the cases that came out having to do with kind of a cult, satanic murder group that really terrorized the area in 79 and 80. Fall River was like a lot of cities in the sense that it had been prosperous at one time and had been known for its textiles. Once factories closed and left, you had a lot of urban, quote-unquote, urban blight, which opened the door for criminal activity, namely drug selling, drug use, and prostitution. And things really got started in this particular case in October of 1979. A woman by the name of Doreen Levesque, she's only 17 years old, so She had been prostituting herself. She was found with her wrists bound by fishing line. And that's as much of a description as I'm going to get into as far as the treatment of her her body.
Did you read anything about the 15-year-old?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, so, yeah.
Yeah. Some of this stuff is super disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
And they do get into it to an extent in the movie, too. But,
right.
But it's not like your fun paranormal research stuff. This is really disturbing stuff.
Right. Yep. So in the wake of her body being discovered, one by one, members of this group approached police and started confessing or pointing the finger at other members of the group in order to indicate that they had been, you know, either the main participant or had been witnesses to the murder of, at first, Doreen Levesque. And that introduces us. There's a man who said that he was concerned about a woman named Barbara Raposa. And then he introduced the police to two women, Karen Marsden and Robin Murphy. And, you know, long story short, that also brought up a man named Carl Drew, who all of these people that I've named so far had some type of participatory role in a crude satanic cult. And Karen Marsden started talking a lot to police about who killed Doreen Levesque, to the degree that she was absolutely petrified by the idea that she would be next, and she was. Unfortunately, she was right. And, you know, it all sort of came crashing down. Marsden was killed. Her skull was discovered on a nearby beach, and everybody started giving up each other. Robin Murphy pointed the finger at Carl Drew, and others said that she was really the one who was mainly involved in disposing of these people. But really, by any stretch of the imagination, Karen Marsden's death was abominable. I mean, the things that happened to her are really indescribable.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out through detective work and police work and the trial that it certainly seemed as if this group was engaging in bona fide, homegrown, but bona fide satanic sacrifice.
Devil worship, yeah.
Yeah, where they would do some type of blood sacrifice, either of an animal or animals or people.
Mm-hmm.
And use those in their rituals. And they were, I mean, the bottom line is that according to, you know, the witnesses and testimony and so forth, they were trying to summon Satan.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably worth mentioning, like, the satanic panic was, at least in the beginning, was at least rooted somewhat in reality. Like, there really was some really disturbing stuff going on, especially in the late 70s, early 80s. But, I mean, a lot of it, too, goes back to, like, Manson and that kind of stuff. So, Freetown became known as a place where bodies were found. It didn't just end with, like, the occult stuff. It also stretched to, it seemed like mob-related hits were carried out, and then bodies were dumped in that area. Anytime you have a state forest or a national forest, that inevitably happens, it seems like. I mean, even here in Cuyahoga Valley, you've got at least one body found per year. So, but Freetown has really become known as, like, that kind of thing. And that's what I was saying. Like, each area of the Bridgewater Triangle almost seems to have its own different mood or weird history. And Freetown State Forest doesn't seem like it's a happy sort of place. And the history of the bizarre that's taken place there isn't something that I typically like to look into.
Right.
I mean, I started reading on some of this stuff and it really was like a turnoff almost instantly for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for sensitive souls, I would not recommend that you look into this story very deeply because it's twisted in ways that, you know, I don't think either one of us wants to go there in terms of describing it. Well, I think the thing that sets this story apart from other satanic panic sort of rumors is the fall in the case of the Fall River cult. you had detectives who actually went undercover
right.
and were present
yeah.
at some of these ritualistic gatherings, and they saw the things that were done, not on the really grisly end of the scale, but certainly, you know, things like, inviting an evil spirit or even Satan himself to possess you.
We have to start wrapping up on this episode, but one thing I did want to mention, Lauren hates when the satanic angle is brought into the Bridgewater Triangle. So we already, hopefully Lauren never listens to this. He'll be upset we talked about this. He likes to keep it strictly to the paranormal. And I had this conversation, actually, strangely enough, with him not that long ago in mm-hmm. reference to something completely different. I mm-hmm. think it might have actually been because of the Bray Road Beast movie. But we talked about this somewhat. So... wrap up for us, sum up your kind of closing thoughts on the Bridgewater Triangle.
I think the classic sort of place to either begin or end is the whole idea of was the area that we think of as the Bridgewater Triangle the essential cause of everything mm-hmm. that has happened there since, you know, whether it's a ritual murder or just the more benign, you know, Bigfoot's eating a pumpkin and he walks away with the pumpkin, which is an actual sighting from mm-hmm. the Hockomock Swamp area. Mm-hmm. But, is the area causing it, or did the area get stained, if you will, by real life tragic events like King Philip's War? And I don't know that that's an answerable question, but I think it's thinking along the right sort of lines. And certainly what it brings up for me, and this is a completely personal comment, is the complicated history that we really still have with the treatment of the Native Americans. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of what gets filed under the, you know, the Native American spirits being cited in mm-hmm. campfires and something is sort of a working out of the sort of the floating guilt that's still out there mm-hmm. about how Native Americans were treated by colonists and settlers. And there's so much in that King Philip's War story, I think, that shows, you know, looking backwards, how much regret there really is over how things went. And that tends to be a part of our history that we want to not mm-hmm. even think about.
Sure.
And maybe the whole Hockomock Swamp and Bridgewater Triangle is a way of that not being forgotten.
And Point Pleasant,
yeah.
All right. If you want to find us on Facebook, it's facebook.com/Monsteropolis. We are on Twitter at
Monsters 971 FM.
This will probably be a running thing every
I
week.
Yeah.
We are also on email. We have email. MonsteropolisMail@gmail.com. Send us your thoughts. And please leave a rating and review on iTunes or your favorite podcatcher. I think that does it. Next week, we're going to be talking about the Sasquatch Triangle in Ohio, home to Seth Breedlove.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com and is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.